the door. Hello, Selden. Going too? You're an Epicurean like myself, I see. You don't want to see all those goddesses gobbling terrapin. God, what a show of good-looking women. But not one of them could touch that little cousin of mine. Talk of jewels. What's a woman want with jewels when she's got herself to show? The trouble is that all these falbals they wear cover up their figures when they've got 'em. I never knew till tonight what an outline Lily has. It's not her fault if everybody don't know it now, growled Trenor, flushed with the struggle of getting into his fur-lined coat. Damn bad taste, I call it. No cigar for me. You can't tell we're just smoking in one of these new houses. Likely as not, the chef buys the cigars. Stay for supper, not if I know it. When people crowd the room so that you can't get near anyone you want to speak to, I'd as soon sup in the elevator at the rush hour. My wife was dead right to stay away. She says life's too short to spend it in breaking in new people. Chapter 13 Lily woke from happy dreams to find two notes at her bedside. One was from Mrs. Trenor, who announced that she was coming to town that afternoon for a flying visit and hoped Miss Bart would be able to dine with her. The other was from Selden. He wrote briefly that an important case called him to Albany, whence he would be unable to return till the evening, and asked Lily to let him know at what hour on the following day she would see him. Lily, leaning back among her pillows, gazed musingly at his letter. The scene in the Bryars' conservatory had been like a part of her dreams. She had not expected to wake to such evidence of its reality. Her first movement was one of annoyance. This unforeseen act of Selden's added another complication to life. It was so unlike him to yield to such an irrational impulse. Did he really mean to ask her to marry him? She had once shown him the impossibility of such a hope, and his subsequent behaviour seemed to prove that he had accepted the situation with a reasonableness somewhat mortifying to her vanity. It was all the more agreeable to find that this reasonableness was maintained only at the cost of not seeing her. But though nothing in life was as sweet as the sense of her power over him, she saw the danger of allowing the episode of the previous night to have a sequel. Since she could not marry him, it would be kinder to him, as well as easier for herself, to write a line amicably evading his request to see her. He was not the man to mistake such a hint, and when next they met, it would be on their usual friendly footing. Lily sprang out of bed and went straight to her desk. She wanted to write at once, while she could trust to the strength of her resolve. She was still languid from her brief sleep and the exhilaration of the evening, and the sight of Selden's writing brought back the culminating moment of her triumph, the moment when she had read in his eyes that no philosophy was proof against her power. It would be pleasant to have that sensation again. No one else could give it to her in its fullness, and she could not bear to mar her mood of luxurious retrospection by an act of definite refusal. She took up her pen and wrote hastily, "Tomorrow at 4," murmuring to herself as she slipped the sheet into its envelope, "I can easily put him off when tomorrow comes." Judy Trenor's summons was very welcome to Lily. It was the first time she had received a direct communication from Bellamont since the close of her last visit there, and she was still visited by the dread of having incurred Judy's displeasure. But this characteristic command seemed to re-establish their former relations, and Lily smiled at the thought that her friend had probably summoned her in order to hear about the Bryars' entertainment. Mrs. Trenor had absented herself from the feast, perhaps for the reason so frankly enunciated by her husband, perhaps because, as Mrs. Fisher somewhat differently put it, she couldn't bear new people when she hadn't discovered them herself. At any rate, though she remained haughtily at Bellamont, Lily suspected in her a devouring eagerness to hear of what she had missed, and to learn exactly in what measure Mrs. Wellington Bry had surpassed all previous competitors for social recognition. Lily was quite ready to gratify this curiosity, but it happened that she was dining out. She determined, however, to see Mrs. Trenor for a few moments, and ringing for her maid, she dispatched a telegram to say that she would be with her friend that evening at 10. She was dining with Mrs. Fisher, who had gathered at an informal feast a few of the performers of the previous evening. There was to be plantation music in the studio after dinner, for Mrs. Fisher, despairing of the Republic, had taken up modelling, and annexed to her small crowded house a spacious apartment, which, whatever its uses in her hours of plastic inspiration, served at other times for the exercise of an indefatigable hospitality. Lily was reluctant to leave, for the dinner was amusing, and she would have liked to lounge over a cigarette and hear a few songs. But she could not break her engagement with Judy, and shortly after 10 she asked her hostess to ring for a hansom and drove up Fifth Avenue to the Trenners. She waited long enough on the doorstep to wonder that Judy's presence in town was not signalized by a greater promptness in admitting her, and her surprise was increased when, instead of the expected footman pushing his shoulders into a tardy coat, a shabby, caretaking person in calico led her into the shrouded hall. Trenner, however, appeared at once on the threshold of the drawing-room, welcoming her with unusual volubility while he relieved her of her cloak and drew her into the room.
"Come along to the den. It's the only comfortable place in the house. Doesn't this room look as if it was waiting for the body to be brought down? Can't see why Judy keeps the house wrapped up in this awful, slippery white stuff. It's enough to give a fellow pneumonia to walk through these rooms on a cold day. You look a little pinched yourself, by the way. It's rather a sharp night out. I noticed it walking up from the club. Come along, and I'll give you a nip of brandy. You can toast yourself over the fire and try some of my new Egyptians. That little Turkish chap at the embassy put me on to a brand that I want you to try, and if you like him, I'll get out a lot for you. They don't have him here yet, but I'll cable."
He led her through the house to a large room at the back, where Mrs. Trenner usually sat, and where, even in her absence, there was an air of occupancy. Here, as usual, were flowers, newspapers, a littered writing-table, and a general aspect of lamplit familiarity, so that it was a surprise not to see Judy's energetic figure start up from the armchair near the fire. It was apparently Trenner himself who had been occupying the seat in question, for it was overhung by a cloud of cigar smoke, and near it stood one of those intricate folding tables which British ingenuity has devised to facilitate the circulation of tobacco and spirits. The sight of such appliances in a drawing-room was not unusual in Lily's set, where smoking and drinking were unrestricted by considerations of time and place, and her first movement was to help herself to one of the cigarettes recommended by Trenner, while she checked his loquacity by asking, with a surprised glance, "Where's Judy?" Trenner, a little heated by his unusual flow of words, and perhaps by prolonged propinquity with the decanters, was bending over the latter to decipher their silver labels.
"Here now, Lily. Just a drop of cognac and a little fizzy water. You do look pinched, you know. I swear the end of your nose is red. I'll take another glass to keep you company. Judy, why, you see, Judy's got a devil of a headache. Quite knocked out with it, poor thing. She asked me to explain. Make it all right, you know. Do come up to the fire, though. You look dead beat, really. Now do let me make you comfortable. There's a good girl."
He had taken her hand, half banteringly, and was drawing her toward a low seat by the hearth, but she stopped and freed herself quietly. "Do you mean to say that Judy's not well enough to see me? Doesn't you want me to go upstairs?" Trenner drained the glass he'd filled for himself, and paused to set it down before he answered,
"Why, no. The fact is, she's not up to seeing anybody. Came on suddenly, you know. She asked me to tell you how awfully sorry she was. If she'd known where you were dining, she'd have sent you word."
"She did know where I was dining. I mentioned it in my telegram. But it doesn't matter, of course. I suppose if she's so poorly, she won't go back to Bellamont in the morning, and I can come and see her then."
"Yes, exactly. That's capital. I'll tell her you'll pop in tomorrow morning. And now do sit down a minute, there's a dear, and let's have a nice, quiet jaw together. You won't take a drop, just for sociability. Tell me what you think of that cigarette. Why, don't you like it? What are you chucking it away for?"
"I'm chucking it away because I must go, if you'll have the goodness to call a cab for me," Lily returned with a smile. She did not like Trenner's unusual excitability with its too evident explanation, and the thought of being alone with him, with her friend out of reach upstairs at the other end of the great empty house, did not conduce to a desire to prolong their tête-à-tête. But Trenner, with a promptness which did not escape her, had moved between herself and the door.
"Why must you go, I should like to know? If Judy'd been here, you'd have sat gossiping till all hours. You can't even give me 5 minutes. It's always the same story. Last night I couldn't get near you. I went to that damn vulgar party just to see you, and there was everybody talking about you and asking me if I'd ever seen anything so stunning. And when I tried to come up and say a word, you never took any notice. You just went on laughing and joking with a lot of asses, who only wanted to be able to swagger about afterward and look knowing when you were mentioned.
He paused, flushed by his diatribe, and fixing on her a look in which resentment was the ingredient she least disliked. But she had regained her presence of mind and stood composedly in the middle of the room, while her slight smile seemed to put an ever-increasing distance between herself and Trenor. Across it she said, "Don't be absurd, Gus. It's past 11, and I must really ask you to ring for a cab." He remained immovable, with the lowering forehead she had grown to detest.
"And supposing I won't ring for one, what'll you do then?"
"I shall go upstairs to Judy if you force me to disturb her." Trenor drew a step nearer and laid his hand on her arm.
"Look here, Lily, won't you give me 5 minutes of your own accord?"
"Not tonight, Gus. You..."
"Very good, then. I'll take them. And as many more as I want."
He had squared himself on the threshold, his hands thrust deep in his pockets. He nodded toward the chair on the hearth.
"Go and sit down there, please. I've got a word to say to you."
Lily's quick temper was getting the better of her fears. She drew herself up and moved toward the door. "If you have anything to say to me, you must say it another time. I shall go up to Judy unless you call a cab for me at once." He burst into a laugh.
"Go upstairs and welcome, my dear. But you won't find Judy. She ain't there."
Lily cast a startled look upon him. "Do you mean that Judy is not in the house? Not in town?" she exclaimed.
"That's just what I do mean," returned Trenor, his bluster sinking to sullenness under her look.
"Nonsense. I don't believe you. I'm going upstairs," she said impatiently. He drew unexpectedly aside, letting her reach the threshold unimpeded.
"Go up and welcome. But my wife is at Bellomont."
But Lily had a flash of reassurance. If she hadn't come, she would have sent me word.
"She did. She telephoned me this afternoon to let you know."
"I received no message."
"I didn't send any."
The two measured each other for a moment, but Lily still saw her opponent through a blur of scorn that made all other considerations indistinct. "I can't imagine your object in playing such a stupid trick on me, but if you have fully gratified your peculiar sense of humor, I must again ask you to send for a cab." It was the wrong note, and she knew it as she spoke. To be stung by irony, it is not necessary to understand it, and the angry streaks on Trenor's face might have been raised by an actual lash.
"Look here, Lily, don't take that high and mighty tone with me."
He had again moved toward the door, and in her instinctive shrinking from him, she let him regain command of the threshold.
"I did play a trick on you. I own up to it. But if you think I'm ashamed, you're mistaken. Lord knows I've been patient enough. I've hung around and looked like an ass. And all the while you were letting a lot of other fellows make up to you. Letting them make fun of me, I dare say. I'm not sharp and can't dress my friends up to look funny as you do. But I can tell when it's being done to me. I can tell fast enough when I'm made a fool of."
"Ah, I shouldn't have thought that," flashed from Lily. But her laugh dropped to silence under his look.
"No, you wouldn't have thought it. But you'll know better now. That's what you're here for tonight. I've been waiting for a quiet time to talk things over. And now I've got it, I mean to make you hear me out."
His first rush of inarticulate resentment had been followed by a steadiness and concentration of tone more disconcerting to Lily than the excitement preceding it. For a moment her presence of mind forsook her. She had more than once been in situations where a quick swordplay of wit had been needful to cover her retreat. But her frightened heartthrobs told her that here such skill would not avail. To gain time, she repeated, "I don't understand what you want." Trenor had pushed a chair between herself and the door. He threw himself in it and leaned back, looking up at her.
"I'll tell you what I want. I want to know just where you and I stand. Hang it! The man who pays for the dinner is generally allowed to have a seat at table."
She flamed with anger and abasement, and the sickening need of having to conciliate where she longed to humble. "I don't know what you mean, but you must see, Gus, that I can't stay here talking to you at this hour."
"Gad, you go to men's houses fast enough in broad daylight. Strikes me you're not always so deuced careful of appearances."
The brutality of the thrust gave her the sense of dizziness that follows on a physical blow. Rosedale had spoken then. This was the way men talked of her. She felt suddenly weak and defenseless. There was a throb of self-pity in her throat. But all the while another self was sharpening her to vigilance, whispering the terrified warning that every word and gesture must be measured. "If you have brought me here to say insulting things," she began. Trenor laughed.
"Don't talk stage rot. I don't want to insult you. But a man's got his feelings, and you've played with mine too long. I didn't begin this business. Kept out of the way, and left the track clear for the other chaps, till you rummaged me out and set to work to make an ass of me. And an easy job you had of it, too. That's the trouble. It was too easy for you. You got reckless, thought you could turn me inside out and chuck me in the gutter like an empty purse. But by gad, that ain't playing fair. That's dodging the rules of the game. Of course, I know now what you wanted. It wasn't my beautiful eyes you were after. But I tell you what, Miss Lily, you've got to pay up for making me think so."
He rose, squaring his shoulders aggressively, and stepped toward her with a reddening brow. But she held her footing, though every nerve tore at her to retreat as he advanced. "Pay up," she faltered. "Do you mean that I owe you money?" He laughed again.
"Oh, I'm not asking for payment in kind. But there's such a thing as fair play, an interest on one's money, and hang me if I've had as much as a look from you."
"Your money? What have I to do with your money? You advised me how to invest mine. And you must have seen I knew nothing of business. You told me it was all right."
"It was all right. It is, Lily. You're welcome to all of it, and 10 times more. I'm only asking for a word of thanks from you."
He was closer still, with a hand that grew formidable, and the frightened self in her was dragging the other down. "I have thanked you. I've shown I was grateful. What more have you done than any friend might do, or anyone except from a friend?" Trenor caught her up with a sneer.
"I don't doubt you've accepted as much before and chucked the other chaps as you'd like to chuck me. I don't care how you settled your score with them. If you fool them, I'm that much to the good. Don't stare at me like that. I know I'm not talking the way a man is supposed to talk to a girl, but hang it! If you don't like it, you can stop me quick enough. You know I'm mad about you. Damn the money! There's plenty more of it, if that bothers you. I was a brute, Lily. Lily, just look at me!"
Over and over her, the sea of humiliation broke, wave crashing on wave so close that the moral shame was one with the physical dread. It seemed to her that self-esteem would have made her invulnerable, that it was her own dishonor which put a fearful solitude about her. His touch was a shock to her drowning consciousness. She drew back from him with a desperate assumption of scorn. "I've told you I don't understand, but if I owe you money, you shall be paid." Trenor's face darkened to rage. Her recoil of abhorrence had called out the primitive man.
"Ah, you'll borrow from Selden or Rosedale and take your chances of fooling them as you fooled me, unless you've settled your other scores already, and I'm the only one left out in the cold."
She stood silent, frozen to her place. The words were worse than the touch. Her heart was beating all over her body, in her throat, her limbs, her helpless, useless hands. Her eyes travelled despairingly about the room. They lit on the bell, and she remembered that help was in call. Yes, but scandal with it. A hideous mustering of tongues. No, she must fight her way out alone. It was enough that the servants knew her to be in the house with Trenor. There must be nothing to excite conjecture in a way of leaving it. She raised her head and achieved a last clear look at him. "I am here alone with you," she said. "What more have you to say?" To her surprise, Trenor answered the look with a speechless stare. With his last gust of words, the flame had died out, leaving him chill and humbled. It was as though a cold air had dispersed the fumes of his libations, and the situation loomed before him black and naked as the ruins of a fire. Old habits, old restraints, the hand of inherited order, plucked back the bewildered mind which passion had jolted from its ruts. Tanner's eye had the haggard look of the sleepwalker waked on a deathly ledge.
"Go home. Go away from here," he stammered,
and turning his back on her, walked toward the hearth. The sharp release from her fears restored Lily to immediate lucidity. The collapse of Trenor's will left her in control, and she heard herself, in a voice that was her own yet outside herself, bidding him ring for the servant, bidding him give the order for a hansom, directing him to put her in it when it came. Whence the strength came to her she knew not, but an insistent voice warned her that she must leave the house openly, and nerved her in the hall before the hovering caretaker to exchange light words with Trenor and charge him with the usual messages for Judy, while all the while she shook with inward loathing. On the doorstep, with the street before her, she felt a mad throb of liberation, intoxicating as the prisoner's first draught of free air. But the clearness of brain continued, and she noted the mute aspect of Fifth Avenue, guessed at the lateness of the hour, and even observed a man's figure. Was there something half familiar in its outline, which, as she entered the hansom, turned from the opposite corner and vanished in the obscurity of the side street? But with the turn of the wheels, reaction came, and shuddering darkness closed on her. "I can't think. I can't think," she moaned, and leaned her head against the rattling side of the cab. She seemed a stranger to herself, or rather there were two selves in her, the one she had always known, and a new, abhorrent being to which it found itself chained. She had once picked up in a house where she was staying a translation of the Eumenides, and her imagination had been seized by the high terror of the scene where Orestes, in the cave of the Oracle, finds his implacable huntresses asleep and snatches an hour's repose. Yes, the Furies might sometimes sleep, but they were always there in the dark corners, and now they were awake, and the iron clang of their wings was in her brain. She opened her eyes and saw the streets passing, the familiar alien streets. All she looked on was the same, and yet changed. There was a great gulf fixed between today and yesterday. Everything in the past seemed simple, natural, full of daylight, and she was alone in a place of darkness and pollution. Alone. It was the loneliness that frightened her. Her eyes fell on an illuminated clock at a street corner, and she saw that the hands marked the half-hour after 11. Only 11:30. There were hours and hours left of the night, and she must spend them alone, shuddering, sleepless on her bed. Her soft nature recoiled from this ordeal, which had none of the stimulus of conflict to goad her through it. Oh, the slow, cold drip of the minutes on her head! She had a vision of herself lying on the black walnut bed, and the darkness would frighten her, and if she left the light burning, the dreary details of the room would brand themselves forever on her brain. She had always hated her room at Mrs. Peniston's, its ugliness, its impersonality, the fact that nothing in it was really hers. To a torn heart, uncomforted by human nearness, a room may open almost human arms, and the being to whom no four walls mean more than any others is, at such hours, expatriate everywhere. Lily had no heart to lean on. Her relation with her aunt was as superficial as that of chance lodgers who pass on the stairs. But even had the two been in closer contact, it was impossible to think of Mrs. Peniston's mind as offering shelter or comprehension to such misery as Lily's. As the pain that can be told is but half a pain, so the pity that questions has little healing in its touch. What Lily craved was the darkness made by enfolding arms, the silence which is not solitude, but compassion holding its breath. She started up and looked forth on the passing streets. Gertie. They were nearing Gertie's corner. If she could only reach there before this laboring anguish burst from her breast to her lips. If only she could feel the hold of Gertie's arms while she shook in the ague fit of fear that was coming upon her. She pushed up the door in the roof and called the address to the driver. It was not so late. Gertie might still be waking. And even if she were not, the sound of the bell would penetrate every recess of her tiny apartment and rouse her to answer her friend's call. Chapter 14. Gertie Farish, the morning after the Wellington Bry's entertainment, woke from dreams as happy as lilies. If they were less vivid in hue, more subdued to the half-tints of her personality and her experience, they were for that very reason better suited to her mental vision. Such flashes of joy as Lily moved in would have blinded Miss Farish, who was accustomed, in the way of happiness, to such scant light as shone through the cracks of other people's lives. Now she was the centre of a little illumination of her own, a mild but unmistakable beam, compounded of Lawrence Selden's growing kindness to herself and the discovery that he extended his liking to Lily Bart. If these two factors seem incompatible to the student of feminine psychology, it must be remembered that Gertie had always been a parasite in the moral order, living on the crumbs of other tables and content to look through the window at the banquet spread for her friends. Now that she was enjoying a little private feast of her own, it would have seemed incredibly selfish not to lay a plate for a friend, and there was no one with whom she would rather have shared her enjoyment than Miss Bart. As to the nature of Selden's growing kindness, Gertie would no more have dared to define it than she would have tried to learn a butterfly's colours by knocking the dust from its wings. To seize on the wonder would be to brush off its bloom, and perhaps see it fade and stiffen in her hand. Better the sense of beauty palpitating out of reach, while she held her breath and watched where it would alight. Yet Selden's manner at the Brys had brought the flutter of wings so close that they seemed to be beating in her own heart. She had never seen him so alert, so responsive, so attentive to what she had to say. His habitual manner had an absent-minded kindliness which she accepted and was grateful for, as the liveliest sentiment her presence was likely to inspire. But she was quick to feel in him a change, implying that for once she could give pleasure as well as receive it. And it was so delightful that this higher degree of sympathy should be reached through their interest in Lily Bart. Gertie's affection for her friend, a sentiment that had learned to keep itself alive on the scantiest diet, had grown to active adoration since Lily's restless curiosity had drawn her into the circle of Miss Farish's work. Lily's taste of beneficence had wakened in her a momentary appetite for well-doing. Her visit to the girls' club had first brought her in contact with the dramatic contrasts of life. She had always accepted with philosophic calm the fact that such existences as hers were pedestaled on foundations of obscure humanity. The dreary limbo of dinginess lay all around and beneath that little illuminated circle in which life reached its finest efflorescence, as the mud and sleet of a winter night enclose a hothouse filled with tropical flowers. All this was in the natural order of things, and the orchid, basking in its artificially created atmosphere, could round the delicate curves of its petals undisturbed by the ice on the panes. But it is one thing to live comfortably with the abstract conception of poverty, another to be brought in contact with its human embodiments. Lily had never conceived of these victims of fate otherwise than in the mass. That the mass was composed of individual lives, innumerable separate centres of sensation, with her own eager reachings for pleasure, her own fierce revulsions from pain, that some of these bundles of feeling were clothed in shapes not so unlike her own, with eyes meant to look on gladness, and young lips shaped for love. This discovery gave Lily one of those sudden shocks of pity that sometimes decentralize a life. Lily's nature was incapable of such renewal. She could feel other demands only through her own, and no pain was long vivid which did not press on an answering nerve. But for the moment she was drawn out of herself by the interest of her direct relation with a world so unlike her own. She had supplemented her first gift by personal assistance to one or two of Miss Farish's most appealing subjects, and the admiration and interest her presence excited among the tired workers at the club ministered in a new form to her insatiable desire to please. Gertie Farish was not a close enough reader of character to disentangle the mixed threads of which Lily's philanthropy was woven. She supposed her beautiful friend to be actuated by the same motive as herself, that sharpening of the moral vision which makes all human suffering so near and insistent that the other aspects of life fade into remoteness. Goethe lived by such simple formulas that she did not hesitate to class her friend's state with the emotional change of heart to which her dealings with the poor had accustomed her, and she rejoiced in the thought that she had been the humble instrument of this renewal. Now she had an answer to all criticisms of Lily's conduct. As she had said, she knew the real Lily, and the discovery that Selden shared her knowledge raised her placid acceptance of life to a dazzled sense of its possibilities, a sense farther enlarged in the course of the afternoon by the receipt of a telegram from Selden asking if he might dine with her that evening. While Gertie was lost in the happy bustle which this announcement produced in her small household, Selden was at one with her in thinking with intensity of Lily Bart. The case which had called him to Albany was not complicated enough to absorb all his attention, and he had the professional faculty of keeping a part of his mind free when its services were not needed. This part, which at the moment seemed dangerously like the whole, was filled to the brim with the sensations of the previous evening. Selden understood the symptoms. He recognized the fact that he was paying up, as there had always been a chance of his having to pay up, for the voluntary exclusions of his past. He had meant to keep free from permanent ties, not from any poverty of feeling, but because, in a different way, he was, as much as Lily, the victim of his environment. There had been a germ of truth in his declaration to Gertie Farish that he had never wanted to marry a nice girl, the adjective connoting in his cousin's vocabulary certain utilitarian qualities which are apt to preclude the luxury of charm. Now it had been Selden's fate to have a charming mother. Her graceful portrait, all smiles and cashmere, still emitted a faded scent of the undefinable quality. His father was the kind of man who delights in a charming woman, who quotes her, stimulates her, and keeps her perennially charming. Neither one of the couple cared for money, but their disdain of it took the form of always spending a little more than was prudent. If their house was shabby, it was exquisitely kept. If there were good books on the shelves, there were also good dishes on the table. Selden Senior had an eye for a picture, his wife an understanding of old lace, and both were so conscious of restraint and discrimination in buying that they never quite knew how it was that the bills mounted up. Though many of Selden's friends would have called his parents poor, he had grown up in an atmosphere where restricted means were felt only as a check on aimless profusion, where the few possessions were so good that their rarity gave them a merited relief, and abstinence was combined with elegance in a way exemplified by Mrs. Selden's knack of wearing her old velvet as if it were new. A man has the advantage of being delivered early from the home point of view, and before Selden left college he had learned that there are as many different ways of going without money as of spending it. Unfortunately, he found no way as agreeable as that practiced at home, and his views of womankind in especial were tinged by the remembrance of the one woman who had given him his sense of values. It was from her that he inherited his detachment from the sumptuary side of life, the Stoic's carelessness of material things combined with the Epicurean's pleasure in them. Life shorn of either feeling appeared to him a diminished thing, and nowhere was the blending of the two ingredients so essential as in the character of a pretty woman. It had always seemed to Selden that experience offered a great deal besides the sentimental adventure, yet he could vividly conceive of a love which should broaden and deepen till it became the central fact of life. What he could not accept, in his own case, was the makeshift alternative of a relation that should be less than this, that should leave some portions of his nature unsatisfied while it put an undue strain on others. He would not, in other words, yield to the growth of an affection which might appeal to pity, yet leave the understanding untouched. Sympathy should no more delude him than a trick of the eyes, the grace of helplessness than a curve of the cheek. But now, that little but passed like a sponge over all his vows. His reasoned-out resistances seemed for the moment so much less important than the question as to when Lily would receive his note. He yielded himself to the charm of trivial preoccupations, wondering at what hour her reply would be sent, with what words it would begin. As to its import, he had no doubt. He was as sure of her surrender as of his own. And so he had leisure to muse on all its exquisite details, as a hard worker on a holiday morning might lie still and watch the beam of light travel gradually across his room. But if the new light dazzled, it did not blind him. He could still discern the outline of facts, though his own relation to them had changed. He was no less conscious than before of what was said of Lily Bart, but he could separate the woman he knew from the vulgar estimate of her. His mind turned to Gertie Farish's words, and the wisdom of the world seemed a groping thing beside the insight of innocence. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, even the hidden God in their neighbor's breast. Selden was in the state of impassioned self-absorption that the first surrender to love produces. His craving was for the companionship of one whose point of view should justify his own, who should confirm, by deliberate observation, the truth to which his intuitions had leaped. He could not wait for the midday recess, but seized a moment's leisure in court to scribble his telegram to Gertie Farish. Reaching town, he was driven direct to his club, where he hoped a note from Miss Bart might await him. But his box contained only a line of rapturous assent from Gertie, and he was turning away disappointed when he was hailed by a voice from the smoking room.
"Hello, Lawrence. Dining here? Take a bite with me. I've ordered a canvas back."
He discovered Trenor in his day clothes, sitting with a tall glass at his elbow, behind the folds of a sporting journal. Selden thanked him, but pleaded an engagement.
"Hang it. I believe every man in town has an engagement tonight. I shall have the club to myself. You know how I'm living this winter, rattling round in that empty house. My wife meant to come to town today, but she's put it off again. How's a fellow to dine alone in a room with the looking-glasses covered, nothing but a bottle of Harvey sauce on the sideboard? I say, Lawrence, chuck your engagement and take pity on me. Gives me the blue devils to dine alone. There's nobody but that canting ass Weatherall in the club."
"Sorry, Gus, I can't do it." As Selden turned away, he noticed the dark flush on Trenor's face, the unpleasant moisture of his intensely white forehead, the way his jewelled rings were wedged in the creases of his fat red fingers. Certainly the beast was predominating, the beast at the bottom of the glass. And he had heard this man's name coupled with Lily's. Bah! The thought sickened him. All the way back to his rooms, he was haunted by the sight of Trenor's fat, creased hands. On his table lay the note. Lily had sent it to his rooms. He knew what was in it before he broke the seal, a grey seal with "Beyond" beneath a flying ship. Ah, he would take her beyond, beyond the ugliness, the pettiness, the attrition and corrosion of the soul. Gertie's little sitting room sparkled with welcome when Selden entered it. Its modest effects, compact of enamel paint and ingenuity, spoke to him in the language just then sweetest to his ear. It is surprising how little narrow walls and a low ceiling matter when the roof of the soul has suddenly been raised. Gertie sparkled too, or at least shone with a tempered radiance. He had never before noticed that she had points. Really, some good fellow might do worse. Over the little dinner, and here again the effects were wonderful, he told her she ought to marry. He was in a mood to pair off the whole world. She had made the caramel custard with her own hands. It was sinful to keep such gifts to herself. He reflected with a throb of pride that Lily could trim her own hats. She had told him so the day of their walk at Bellamont. He did not speak of Lily till after dinner. During the little repast, he kept the talk on his hostess, who, fluttered at being the center of observation, shone as rosy as the candle shade she had manufactured for the occasion. Selden evinced an extraordinary interest in her household arrangements, complimented her on the ingenuity with which she had utilized every inch of her small quarters, asked how her servant managed about afternoons out, learned that one may improvise delicious dinners in a chafing dish, and uttered thoughtful generalizations on the burden of a large establishment. When they were in the sitting room again, where they fitted as snugly as bits in a puzzle, and she had brewed the coffee and poured it into her grandmother's eggshell cups, his eye, as he leaned back, basking in the warm fragrance, lighted on a recent photograph of Miss Bart, and the desired transition was effected without an effort. The photograph was well enough, but to catch her as she had looked last night. Gertie agreed with him. Never had she been so radiant. But could photography capture that light? There had been a new look in her face, something different. Yes, Selden agreed, there had been something different. The coffee was so exquisite that he asked for a second cup, such a contrast to the watery stuff at the club. Ah, your poor bachelor with his impersonal club fare, alternating with the equally impersonal cuisine of the dinner party. A man who lived in lodgings missed the best part of life. He pictured the flavourless solitude of Trenor's repast, and felt a moment's compassion for the man. But to return to Lily. And again he returned, questioning, conjecturing, leading Gertie on, draining her inmost thoughts of their stored tenderness for her friend. At first she poured herself out unstintingly, happy in this perfect communion of their sympathies. His understanding of Lily helped to confirm her own belief in her friend. They dwelt together on the fact that Lily had had no chance. Gertie instanced her generous impulses, her restlessness and discontent. The fact that her life had never satisfied her proved that she was made for better things. She might have married more than once, the conventional rich marriage which she had been taught to consider the sole end of existence. But when the opportunity came, she had always shrunk from it. Percy Gryce, for instance, had been in love with her. Everyone at Bellamont had supposed them to be engaged, and her dismissal of him was thought inexplicable. This view of the Gryce incident chimed too well with Selden's mood, not to be instantly adopted by him, with a flash of retrospective contempt for what had once seemed the obvious solution. If rejection there had been, and he wondered now that he had ever doubted it, then he held the key to the secret, and the hillsides of Bellamont were lit up not with sunset, but with dawn. It was he who had wavered and disowned the face of opportunity, and the joy now warming his breast might have been a familiar inmate if he had captured it in its first flight. It was at this point, perhaps, that a joy just trying its wings in Gertie's heart dropped to earth and lay still. She sat facing Selden, repeating mechanically, "No, she has never been understood." And all the while she herself seemed to be sitting in the centre of a great glare of comprehension. The little confidential room, where a moment ago their thoughts had touched elbows like their chairs, grew to unfriendly vastness, separating her from Selden by all the length of her new vision of the future. And that future stretched out interminably, with her lonely figure toiling down it, a mere speck on the solitude. "She's herself for the few people only, and you are one of them," she heard Selden saying. And again, "Be good to her, Gertie, won't you?" And, "She has it in her to become whatever she is believed to be. You'll help her by believing the best of her." The words beat on Gertie's brain like the sound of a language which has seemed familiar at a distance, but on approaching is found to be unintelligible. He had come to talk to her of Lily, that was all. There had been a third at the feast she had spread for him, and that third had taken her own place. She tried to follow what he was saying, to cling to her own part in the talk. But it was all as meaningless as the boom of waves in a drowning head, and she felt, as the drowning may feel, that to sink would be nothing beside the pain of struggling to keep up. Selden rose, and she drew a deep breath, feeling that soon she could yield to the blessed waves. "Mrs. Fisher's, you say she was dining there. There's music afterward. I believe I had a card from her." He glanced at the foolish pink-faced clock that was drumming out this hideous hour. 9:15. I might look in there now. The Fisher evenings are amusing. I haven't kept you up too late, Gertie. You look tired. I've rambled on and bored you." And in the unwonted overflow of his feelings, he left a cousinly kiss upon her cheek. At Mrs. Fisher's, through the cigar smoke of the studio, a dozen voices greeted Selden. A song was pending as he entered, and he dropped into a seat near his hostess, his eyes roaming in search of Miss Bart. But she was not there, and the discovery gave him a pang out of all proportion to its seriousness, since the note in his breast pocket assured him that at 4 the next day they would meet. To his impatience it seemed immeasurably long to wait, and half ashamed of the impulse he leaned to Mrs. Fisher to ask, as the music ceased, if Miss Bart had not dined with her. "Lily, she's just gone. She had to run off, I forget where. Wasn't she wonderful last night?
Who's that, Lily?
Asked Jack Stepney from the depths of a neighboring armchair.
Really, you know, I'm no prude, but when it comes to a girl standing there as if she was up at auction, I thought seriously of speaking to Cousin Julia.
You didn't know Jack had become our social censor, Mrs. Fisher said to Selden with a laugh. And Stepney spluttered amid the general derision.
But she's a cousin, hang it, and when a man's married, town talk was full of her this morning.
Yes, lively reading that was, said Mr. Ned Van Alstyne, stroking his moustache to hide the smile behind it.
By the dirty sheet? No, of course not. Some fellow showed it to me, but I'd heard the stories before. When a girl's as good-looking as that, she'd better marry. Then no questions are asked. In our imperfectly organized society, there is no provision as yet for the young woman who claims the privileges of marriage without assuming its obligations.
Well, I understand Lily is about to assume them in the shape of Mr. Rosedale, Mrs. Fisher said with a laugh.
Rosedale, good heavens, exclaimed Van Alstyne, dropping his eyeglass. Stepney, that's your fault for foisting the brute on us.
Oh, confound it, you know, we don't marry Rosedale in our family, Stepney languidly protested. But his wife, who sat in oppressive bridal finery at the other side of the room, quelled him with the judicial reflection. In Lily's circumstances, it's a mistake to have too high a standard.
I hear even Rosedale has been scared by the talk lately, Mrs. Fisher rejoined. But the sight of her last night sent him off his head.
What do you think he said to me after her tableau?
My God, Mrs. Fisher, if I could get Paul Morpeth to paint her like that, the picture would appreciate 100% in 10 years.
By Jove!
But isn't she about somewhere? Exclaimed Van Alstyne, restoring his glass with an uneasy glance.
No, she ran off while you were all mixing the punch downstairs. Where was she going, by the way? What's on tonight? I hadn't heard of anything.
Oh, not a party, I think, said an inexperienced young fairy who had arrived late. I put her in a cab as I was coming in, and she gave the driver the Trenners' address.
The Trenners? Exclaimed Mrs. Jack Stepney. Why, the house is closed. Judy telephoned me from Bellamont this evening.
Did she? That's queer. I'm sure I'm not mistaken. Well, come now, Trenner's there. Anyhow,
Oh.
Well, the fact is, I've no head for numbers.
He broke off, admonished by the nudge of an adjoining foot and the smile that circled the room. In its unpleasant light, Selden had risen and was shaking hands with his hostess. The air of the place stifled him, and he wondered why he had stayed in it so long. On the doorstep, he stood still, remembering a phrase of Lily's. It seems to me you spend a good deal of time in the element you disapprove of. Well, what had brought him there but the quest of her? It was her element, not his. But he would lift her out of it, take her beyond. That beyond on her letter was like a cry for rescue. He knew that Perseus's task is not done when he has loosed Andromeda's chains, for her limbs are numb with bondage, and she cannot rise and walk, but clings to him with dragging arms as he beats back to land with his burden. Well, he had strength for both. It was her weakness which had put the strength in him. It was not, alas, a clean rush of waves they had to win through, but a clogging morass of old associations and habits, and for the moment its vapours were in his throat. But he would see clearer, breathe freer in her presence. She was at once the dead weight at his breast, and the spar which should float them to safety. He smiled at the whirl of metaphor with which he was trying to build up a defence against the influences of the last hour. It was pitiable that he, who knew the mixed motives on which social judgments depend, should still feel himself so swayed by them. How could he lift Lily to a freer vision of life if his own view of her was to be coloured by any mind in which he saw her reflected? The moral oppression had produced a physical craving for air, and he strode on, opening his lungs to the reverberating coldness of the night. At the corner of Fifth Avenue, Van Alstyne hailed him with an offer of company.
Walking? A good thing to blow the smoke out of one's head. Now that women have taken to tobacco, we live in a bath of nicotine. It would be a curious thing to study the effect of cigarettes on the relation of the sexes. Smoke is almost as great a solvent as divorce. Both tend to obscure the moral issue. Nothing could have been less consonant with Selden's mood than Van Alstyne's after-dinner aphorisms. But as long as the latter confined himself to generalities, his listener's nerves were in control. Happily, Van Alstyne prided himself on his summing up of social aspects,
and with Selden for audience, was eager to show the sureness of his touch. Mrs. Fisher lived in an east side street near the park, and as the two men walked down Fifth Avenue, the new architectural developments of that versatile thoroughfare invited Van Alstyne's comment. "That Griner house now, a typical rung in the social ladder. The man who built it came from a milieu where all the dishes are put on the table at once. His facade is a complete architectural meal. If he had omitted a style, his friends might have thought the money had given out. Not a bad purchase for Rosedale, though. Attracts attention and awes the Western sightseer. By and by he'll get out of that phase and want something that the crowd will pass and the few pause before, especially if he marries my clever cousin." Selden dashed in with the query, "And the Wellington Brys, rather clever of its kind, don't you think?" They were just beneath the wide white facade, with its rich restraint of line, which suggested the clever corseting of a redundant figure. "That's the next stage, the desire to imply that one has been to Europe and has a standard. I'm sure Mrs. Bry thinks her house a copy of the Trianon. In America, every marble house with gilt furniture is thought to be a copy of the Trianon. What a clever chap that architect is, though. How he takes his client's measure. He's put the whole of Mrs. Bry in his use of the composite order. Now, for the Trenors, you remember, he chose the Corinthian, exuberant, but based on the best precedent. The Trenor house is one of his best things. Doesn't look like a banqueting hall turned inside out. I hear Mrs. Trenor wants to build out a new ballroom, and that divergence from Gus on that point keeps her at Bellamont. The dimensions of the Bry's ballroom must rankle. You may be sure she knows him as well as if she'd been there last night with a yard measure. Who said she was in town, by the way? That Farish boy. She isn't, I know. Mrs. Stepney was right. The house is dark, you see. I suppose Gus lives in the back." He had halted opposite the Trenor's corner, and Selden perforce stayed his steps also. The house loomed obscure and uninhabited. Only an oblong gleam above the door spoke of provisional occupancy. "They've bought the house at the back. It gives them 150 feet in the side street. There's where the ballroom's to be, with a gallery connecting it, billiard room and so on above. I suggested changing the entrance and carrying the drawing room across the whole Fifth Avenue front. You see, the front door corresponds with the windows." The walking stick, which Van Alstyne swung in demonstration, dropped to a startled, "Hello," as the door opened and two figures were seen silhouetted against the hall light. At the same moment, a hansom halted at the curbstone, and one of the figures floated down to it in a haze of evening draperies, while the other, black and bulky, remained persistently projected against the light. For an immeasurable second, the two spectators of the incident were silent. Then the house door closed, the hansom rolled off, and the whole scene slipped by as if with the turn of a stereopticon. Van Alstyne dropped his eyeglass with a low whistle.
Nothing of this, eh, Selden? As one of the family, I know I may count on you. Appearances are deceptive, and Fifth Avenue is so imperfectly lighted."
"Good night," said Selden, turning sharply down the side street, without seeing the other's extended hand. Alone with her cousin's kiss, Gertie stared upon her thoughts. He had kissed her before, but not with another woman on his lips. If he had spared her that, she could have drowned quietly, welcoming the dark flood as it submerged her. But now the flood was shot through with glory, and it was harder to drown at sunrise than in darkness. Gertie hid her face from the light, but it pierced to the crannies of her soul. She had been so contented. Life had seemed so simple and sufficient. Why had he come to trouble her with new hopes? And Lily, her best friend. Womanlike, she accused the woman. Perhaps, had it not been for Lily, her fond imaginings might have become truth. Selden had always liked her, had understood and sympathized with the modest independence of her life. He, who had the reputation of weighing all things in the nice balance of fastidious perceptions, had been uncritical and simple in his view of her. His cleverness had never overawed her, because she had felt at home in his heart. And now she was thrust out, and the door barred against her by Lily's hand. Lily, for whose admission there she herself had pleaded. The situation was lighted up by a dreary flash of irony. She knew Selden. She saw how the force of her faith in Lily must have helped to dispel his hesitations. She remembered, too, how Lily had talked of him. She saw herself bringing the two together, making them known to each other. On Selden's part, no doubt, the wound inflicted was inconscient. He had never guessed her foolish secret. But Lily must have known. When in such matters are a woman's perceptions at fault? And if she knew, then she had deliberately despoiled her friend, and in mere wantonness of power, since even to Gertie's suddenly flaming jealousy it seemed incredible that Lily should wish to be Selden's wife. Lily might be incapable of marrying for money, but she was equally incapable of living without it, and Selden's eager investigations into the small economies of housekeeping made him appear to Gertie as tragically duped as herself. She remained long in her sitting-room, where the embers were crumbling to cold grey, and the lamp paled under its gay shade. Just beneath it stood the photograph of Lily Bart, looking out imperially on the cheap gimcracks, the cramped furniture of the little room. Could Selden picture her in such an interior? Gertie felt the poverty, the insignificance of her surroundings. She beheld her life as it must appear to Lily, and the cruelty of Lily's judgments smote upon her memory. She saw that she had dressed her idol with attributes of her own making. When had Lily ever really felt, or pitied, or understood? All she wanted was the taste of new experiences. She seemed like some cruel creature experimenting in a laboratory. The pink-faced clock drummed out another hour, and Gertie rose with a start. She had an appointment early the next morning with a district visitor on the east side. She put out her lamp, covered the fire, and went into her bedroom to undress. In the little glass above her dressing-table she saw her face reflected against the shadows of the room, and tears blotted the reflection. What right had she to dream the dreams of loveliness? A dull face invited a dull fate. She cried quietly as she undressed, laying aside her clothes with her habitual precision, setting everything in order for the next day, when the old life must be taken up as though there had been no break in its routine. Her servant did not come till 8 o'clock, and she prepared her own tea-tray and placed it beside the bed. Then she locked the door of the flat, extinguished her light, and lay down. But on her bed sleep would not come, and she lay face to face with the fact that she hated Lily Bart. It closed with her in the darkness like some formless evil to be blindly grappled with. Reason, judgment, renunciation, all the same daylight forces, were beaten back in the sharp struggle for self-preservation. She wanted happiness, wanted it as fiercely and unscrupulously as Lily did, but without Lily's power of obtaining it. And in her conscious impotence she lay shivering and hated her friend. A ring at the doorbell caught her to her feet. She struck a light and stood startled, listening. For a moment her heart beat incoherently. Then she felt the sobering touch of fact, and remembered that such calls were not unknown in her charitable work. She flung on her dressing gown to answer the summons, and unlocking her door, confronted the shining vision of Lily Bart. Gertie's first movement was one of revulsion. She shrank back, as though Lily's presence flashed too sudden a light upon her misery. Then she heard her name in a cry, had a glimpse of her friend's face, and felt herself caught and clung to. "Lily, what is it?" she exclaimed. Miss Bart released her and stood breathing brokenly, like one who has gained shelter after a long flight. "I was so cold, I couldn't go home. Have you a fire?" Gertie's compassionate instincts, responding to the swift call of habit, swept aside all her reluctances. Lily was simply someone who needed help, for what reason there was no time to pause and conjecture. Disciplined sympathy checked the wonder on Gertie's lips, and made her draw her friend silently into the sitting-room and seat her by the darkened hearth. "There's kindling wood here. The fire will burn in a minute." She knelt down, and the flame leapt under her rapid hands. It flashed strangely through the tears which still blurred her eyes, and smote on the white ruin of Lily's face. The girls looked at each other in silence. Then Lily repeated, "I couldn't go home." "No, no, you came here, dear. You're cold and tired. Sit quiet, and I'll make you some tea." Gertie had unconsciously adopted the soothing note of her trade. All personal feeling was merged in the sense of ministry, and experience had taught her that the bleeding must be stayed before the wound is probed. Lily sat quiet, leaning to the fire. The clatter of cups behind her soothed her, as familiar noises hush a child whom silence has kept wakeful. But when Gertie stood at her side with the tea, she pushed it away and turned an estranged eye on the familiar room. "I came here because I couldn't bear to be alone," she said. Gertie set down the cup and knelt beside her. "Lily, something has happened. Can't you tell me?" "I couldn't bear to lie awake in my room till morning. I hate my room at Aunt Julia's. So I came here." She stirred suddenly, broke from her apathy, and clung to Gertie in a fresh burst of fear. "Oh, Gertie, the Furies! You know the noise of their wings, alone, at night, in the dark. But you don't know. There's nothing to make the dark dreadful to you." The words, flashing back on Gertie's last hours, struck from her a faint, derisive murmur. But Lily, in the blaze of her own misery, was blinded to everything outside it. "You'll let me stay. I shan't mind when daylight comes. Is it late? Is the night nearly over? It must be awful to be sleepless. Everything stands by the bed and stares." Miss Farish caught her straying hands. "Lily, look at me. Something has happened, an accident. You've been frightened. What has frightened you? Tell me, if you can, a word or two, so that I can help you." Lily shook her head. "I'm not frightened. That's not the word. Can you imagine looking into your glass some morning and seeing a disfigurement, some hideous change that has come to you while you slept? Well, I seem to myself like that. I can't bear to see myself in my own thoughts. I hate ugliness, you know. I've always turned from it. But I can't explain to you. You wouldn't understand." She lifted her head, and her eyes fell on the clock. "How long the night is. And I know I shan't sleep tomorrow. Someone told me my father used to lie sleepless and think of horrors. And he was not wicked, only unfortunate. And I see now how he must have suffered, lying alone with his thoughts. But I am bad. A bad girl. All my thoughts are bad. I've always had bad people about me. Is that any excuse? I thought I could manage my own life. I was proud. Proud. But now I'm on their level."
Sobs shook her, and she bowed to them like a tree in a dry storm. Gertie knelt beside her, waiting with the patience born of experience, till this gust of misery should loosen fresh speech. She had first imagined some physical shock, some peril of the crowded streets, since Lily was presumably on her way home from Carrie Fisher's. But she now saw that other nerve centres were smitten, and her mind trembled back from conjecture.